Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I want to get started tonight with a favorite moment from the hit NBC TV series, The Office. Now, in this scene, Dwight, the office's uptight buffoon, is trying to help Erin, the well-meaning but empty-headed receptionist, to learn a second language.
S'il vous plaît, dites-moi, anglais.
Ah, French. It's a great language. If you're a chain-smoking acrobat, you want to learn a really impressive second language? Try Dothraki. Dothraki is the native tongue of the nomadic, warmongering horse lords of Essos, as featured in the superb home box office series Game of Thrones. It has a lot of nudity, which I fast-forward through to get to the chopped-off heads. I could teach you if you want. It's a lot easier than French.
Yeah, let's do it.
Aftavrosa! It means excellent, and we have begun. I throat rip.
Forth agendak.
You throat rip.
Forth agendi.
He, she, it throat rips.
Forth agenda.
More of a barbaric growl.
Forth agenda.
Louder, you're shouting it from the back of a horse.
Forth agenda!
Not bad. For a made-up language, yes, someone actually had to create that Dothraki language for Game of Thrones, and that someone is here with us. So that'll be one mystery solved, and then we'll solve another. Why do people yell out for the Lynyrd Skynyrd song Freebird at concerts that have nothing to do with Lynyrd Skynyrd? And we've got live music from the gifted guitar slinger and songwriter Blake Mills and his band. But first... Dothra-la-tes. Now, if you were Khal Drogo from the Game of Thrones TV series, you'd be hopping on your horse right now, because apparently I just said, let's ride. In George R.R. Martin's fantasy series, a group of people called the Dothraki speak their own language, which we as readers get just little bits and pieces of as we go along. But for those of you who watch Game of Thrones on TV, you'll know that Dothraki has now become a full-fledged language, and you can learn how to speak that language thanks to David J. Peterson. He's a language creator, and he's here with me in the studio today. Hi, David.
Hey, John.
How was my Dothraki there?
It was all right.
It was all right.
You need some rumble in there. Dothra-la-tes.
So you've created this whole language, which when you create a language out of whole cloth, that's one thing. But you had like a few little bits and pieces in the books that you had to incorporate. Did that make this project more difficult?
It was a challenge, but it was actually a good challenge. It was one that I hadn't tried before, but I was very fortunate with the material that I was given. So George R. R. Martin says he's not much of a language guy, that he makes everything up on the spot. But I will tell you, all of the Dothraki bits that he created in the books cohere very well. Mm-hmm. All the words and names look like they came from the same language, which is not an easy thing to do. And all the little parts that could be analyzed grammatically, they hung together very well. So basically, I just started there and made sure that everything that was in there was going to still be good once I was done, and I started building.
Now, you've built a number of languages. They're called conlangs, right?
Conlangs, yeah.
Which stands for?
Constructed language.
Yeah.
Right on.
Possibly one of the best known, or several of the best known, are in Tolkien's trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, where he, you know, Tolkien was a philologist. He knew how languages were constructed, and based... You know, you can kind of tell that the High Elvish is based on Finnish, and some of the other things are based on, like, Old Icelandic or whatever. What is Dothraki based on?
Well, Dothraki is really not based on any one language or even any group of languages. So the way a conlanger works, we kind of go through phases. And one of the phases is to base your work exclusively on one language or a group of languages that you find interesting. Once you kind of move past that, then you can just see the structure and decide, how do I want this language to work? How do I want it to feel when you use it? How do I want it to feel when I translate things? What do I like? And so that's what I did with Dothraki. I kind of aimed for something that would be interesting, would be unique, would have the right sound, and that and something that I would actually like to translate into.
Hmm. So how important is the sound of the language? It kind of has to fit the image of the people that you're portraying.
Right. Well, of course, you know, if you're a producer, the sound is everything. Right. If you're the director, the sound is everything. So that's very, very important. Luckily, that's something that if you're good with it, you can achieve it. And I think that especially if you have great actors to work with, they can sell it. Mm. All of those things are involved. So, I mean, it was a stroke of genius having Jason Momoa play Khal Drogo, because his delivery is just, it's so rock and roll. I absolutely love it.
Well, let's hear him in action. This is a clip from Game of Thrones, and the language that David J. Peterson has created, called Dothraki, is being spoken here by Khal Drogo and by his bride, Daenerys. All right, now, for folks who haven't seen the TV series, mm-hmm. Khal Drogo is a native Dothraki speaker.
Yeah.
Daenerys is not.
Yeah.
So her accent is slightly different.
Yeah, oh gosh, and that's such a wonderful scene
What are they talking about?
Well, in that one, actually, they were talking about she's trying to convince him to kind of, you know, to take some boats across the Narrow Sea and conquer Westeros. And he's just like, well, I don't see any point in that. So that's the discussion that they're having. But it's really nice if you listen to it. And it's been a while since I watched that episode. So I was just listening to it now and smiling because you hear it. You hear Jason Momoa have this really authentic Dothraki sound. And then you hear Daenerys speaking competently, mm-hmm. but nevertheless not natively. So
right.
you can tell it's like she's speaking in kind of a Westerosi way. And it's, God, it's so beautiful to listen to. I'm so happy with it.
So with the Dothraki being a very kind of barbaric people, you didn't want to go for something that had a lot of, like, French sounds, you know, a lot of liquid language. It wouldn't fit the people, right?
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, I think that George R. R. Martin, the words that he created, really laid the groundwork for all the sounds that were in there. Like, based on the spellings he came up with, I came up with pronunciations that I thought were likely, you know, based on how they were spelled. And I only added one sound to Dothraki that I didn't find in the books, and that was ch, because I thought it should be there based on how I analyzed the sound system. So it was all there. Mm-hmm. It was all in the books. That sound was there. And so, like, you know, he laid the groundwork, and then after that, Jason just, you know, did what he did with it.
Right. We're speaking with David J. Peterson, one of the founders of the Language Creation Society. He's worked for the HBO series Game of Thrones, creating the Dothraki language since 2009. And his latest project is a living language Dothraki language instruction course, which is available now, and which, it's not just like words, but it's a language. There's syntax, there's grammar. Do you conjugate the verbs and decline the nouns and all that kind of stuff?
You do both, man. So you know about noun declension, right? On. Yeah, so that's cool. Most English speakers don't.
We don't decline our nouns.
Yeah, we don't.
Yeah,
we
but
don't.
Most languages do.
Yeah, so that's right on, man.
Do the Dothraki?
The Dothraki do. The Dothraki decline their nouns in one of five noun cases, meaning that you change the form of the noun depending on how you use it in the sentence. You conjugate the verbs as well. And when you create a language, when you actually create a full language, you got to create everything. So it's like what you hear in the show, that's just kind of like the veneer, especially if you're not paying attention to what's being said. It's my job to make sure that all of that stuff fits together so that if you analyze it, you can see, yes, there is structure here, and this does work. It is a functional language.
All right, so I want to hear a few more of the words in this language. Now, this is you, David,
okay.
In this recording. This is from the CD that comes with the book.
Cool.
Living Language, Dothraki, by my guest David J. Peterson, and we'll translate these for you in just a sec.
Lokam, Kohol, Orvik, Ize, Ziso. Adrivar, Chadoch.
All right, so those words in order of appearance are arrow, bow, whip, poison, ziso is wound, death, and corpse. What a fun language you've created here. Now, what about the word Dothraki?
Oh, yeah, the word Dothraki. So that was something where I think George R. R. Martin laid the groundwork, but Dothraki actually means riders. So you have the verb stem, Dothra, and then to say somebody who does that action is Dothrak, and then the plural of that, at least in the nominative, is Dothraki, and that's the people, the riders.
Hmm. So language is not divorced from culture. Language and culture are kind of inextricably linked. So did you need to even go beyond what George R. R. Martin did in the book and think about what the culture of these people would be and how that would generate language?
Yeah, so what I did first was scour all of the chapters, all of the Daenerys chapters in the first three books to get everything I could from them, not just from the dialogue, but from, you know, the background details that George R. R. Martin gave. But then the next step after that was going to research what George R. R. Martin researched when he was writing the book. So the Dothraki were based on kind of his research into Native American cultures and in particular the Mongolian culture of Genghis Khan's era. And so then what I did was I did research into those eras and into those climates, especially the climate of Mongolia was very helpful to me to see what it would really mean to be a nomadic tribe in a land like that. You know, what would your days be like? What kind of flora and fauna would you encounter? And that informed my choices into how the vocabulary was expanded.
So is this the way you create a conlang, a constructed language for whomever, whether it's for Defiance, that's on the Sci-Fi Channel,
yeah,
right? Or Game of Thrones, is it always the same way or is it different every time?
It's always the same way in a sense, which is you're always answering the question, why? Every time you sit down to create a language, I mean, the obvious question is, why are you creating this language?
Right.
And obviously, it's for a very different reason if you're creating that language for a fictional people than if you're creating a language that you hope people will use in their everyday lives.
Like Esperanto.
Yeah, like Esperanto. The goals are different. And so depending on why, what the main goal is for this language, what its what its purpose is, that's going to inform every single decision you make at every single level of language creation.
Have you made a conlang that is not for fictional people, but that you hope would be for real use?
Yeah, I did once. I don't think I created it in the hope that a whole bunch of people would use it. But I thought if there was ever a language that I would use, this would be it. And it's one that's actually derived from just a small set of close to 400 words, and that's the maximum number of words it will have, and then everything else is derived from those words. Because I thought, well, if I'm going to use it, I'm pretty lazy. I don't want to memorize a whole bunch of words.
How many Dothraki words are there now? If I take this living language course in Dothraki, how big is my vocabulary likely to be?
Let's see. In the living language course, I think there's about 500 words. Total, there's about 4,000.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's room for more.
So Dothraki speakers, there will be a big fan meetup at the Midtown Bar here in New York called Lansdowne Road on Friday night from 7 to 9. And David here will be, as I say, part of two Comic-Con panels on Sunday, October 12th. The first is Dothraki 101. And the second is How a Game of Thrones Changed Fantasy, or Did It? What do you think? Did Game of Thrones change the fantasy world?
Well, it's anytime you have a work that is extremely influential, it's going to change things. It's going to influence people. But I kind of suspect that we haven't really seen the full effect that it's going to have yet. So it's like the fantasy authors that are really popular and are writing today, they may have been influenced by George R. R. Martin a little bit, but I don't think they will have. I mean, they're still kind of from the Game of Thrones era. So I think that we have to wait to see what happens 5-10 years down the line to really appreciate the full effect.
All right. Now, we talked about the fact that when you create a conlang, a constructed language, you have to also think about the culture that goes with it. Do the Dothraki people have music? Have you written any lyrics in Dothraki?
I've tried my hand at composing haiku, but I haven't done music yet. That's actually something I really wondered about, what their music would be like. I assume that their drumming would be pretty good. I mean, they've got drumming We know they dance. They've got to have music. Everybody has music.
Right,
you know?
Right. And they've got bells in their hair,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
There's got to be something going on.
Yeah, there's got to be.
And every sort of horse-bound culture in human history has had music, usually with that kind of galloping rhythm and stuff. So.
Mm, the old Iron Maiden beat.
All right, now speaking of Iron Maiden, we gave you a couple of selections of, since there's no Dothraki music, we gave you some of our music to translate into Dothraki, and you chose a couple of them, and then you also chose to add in, on your own, this was entirely David J. Peterson's idea, you chose to translate some Iron Maiden into Dothraki. That doesn't seem like it was such a far leap.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm a big Iron Maiden fan, but also they, you know, when you listen to the music, it has the horse pounding beats in there. I love it.
So what song have you translated?
Well, I translated some lyrics from The Trooper, which seems appropriate. And that is the smell of acrid smoke in horse's breath as we plunge on into certain death.
That sounds like a Dothraki song to me. All right, so keeping with the theme of horses, we asked you to translate a very different sounding song, the Rolling Stones ballad Wild Horses. Wild Horses Couldn't Drag Me Away. What's that sound like?
Oh, man, I had a really tough time with the meter of the second line, so I don't know how well it would work, but... Razif Iveji. L'arvo ide ser anadunon. That's Couldn't Drag Me From Here.
Okay. And then the other one is Journey.
Yeah.
Don't Stop Believin'.
This
does not sound like a kind of typical Dothraki conversation.
It's the opposite of Dothraki, but I'm a big Journey fan. I'm a big Journey fan, so yeah.
Well then, sing this one for us, David. Come on.
Oh boy.
Nachos shilolat. Lushas has frachol. Yeah.
It actually was a syllable short there.
Well, it may not have scanned, but it was convincing Dothraki. Don't Stop Believin' from Journey, David J. Peterson translating that into the language Dothraki. He's been creating the Dothraki language for the HBO series Game of Thrones since 2009 and will be part of the two Comic-Con panels on Sunday, Dothraki 101 and How a Game of Thrones Changed Fantasy or Did It. David, great to have you with us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
Up next, how many times have you heard this?
Freebird! Woo!
I know. Like me, you never want to hear from that guy again. But up next, we explore the history of this Lynyrd Skynyrd favorite that has become a surefire buzzkill at live concerts. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. One way to judge whether a song is iconic is if it's sold like a gazillion copies over the course of 40 years, or if it still gets played on the radio every 3 hours. In the case of this song, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird, both of those are true. Though the best argument to be made is that people still yell, Freebird! At live concerts that have nothing to do with the band or even with Southern rock in general. Southern rock is the subject of Scott B. Bomar's new book, Southbound, An Illustrated History of Southern Rock. Scott joins me here in the Soundcheck studio to talk about 40 years of Freebird. Hey,
indeed.
Scott.
How are you?
So Freebird was it released as a single?
It was, yeah.
It's such a long song. How did it fit?
Indeed. You know, originally it was released as a single from Lynyrd Skynyrd's first album. And the original studio version is more than 9 minutes long. It's close to 10 minutes in length. I'm sure certain radio stations probably faded it out at some mm-hmm. point. But, you know, at that time...
Can I tell you, though, from my experience, late night DJs probably played the whole thing.
That's
maybe
right.
more than once.
That's right. I mean, that was sort of the rise of FM and album rock. And, you know, that was a time when people were starting to break the rules. And,
yeah.
and Freebird came along at the right time.
So it has become more than a song. It's become like a cultural trope. You know?
Right. A punchline.
Not too long, just about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, Jeff Tweedy of the band Wilco was performing, and he was trying to figure out what he was going to do next in the set. And listen to this. This is what happened.
Freebird!
I mean, really, at this point, people that do that really should be... taken away, they have their concert privileges taken away. Like an internment camp. Where you're forced to listen to Freebird.
So that's Jeff Tweedy at the Brooklyn Academy of Music trying to play his own music and some joker yells out, Freebird!
Right. Right.
This happens a lot. And, you know, the audience laughs.
Right,
Jeff is like, I think he's mock upset.
Right.
how does Freebird get to occupy this weird spot in the cultural landscape?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, but it was also a single again in 1977 in a live version. The live version was like 14 minutes long. At the end of the album, the last song that they play is Freebird, and you hear the audience yelling, Freebird, Freebird, and Ronnie Van Zant, the lead singer, says, what song is it you want to hear? And he's just baiting the audience
right,
and getting
right.
everybody worked into a froth, and you hear them chanting Freebird, and then, of course, they go into the song, and everybody goes nuts. That album was triple platinum. It was the most successful Lynyrd Skynyrd album ever. And so I think a lot of people heard that record, and it sort of became this this idea of calling out Freebird at the end of a concert. There's actually a DJ in Chicago who in the late 80s claimed that he started the whole thing as a joke, that he was apparently at a Florence Henderson performance of Brady Bunch fame. And he thought it would be funny to call out this because it was just completely bizarre and unrelated. And so there's sort of some Freebird lore that at least one guy claims he started it.
But... I bet there are lots of stories like that.
I'm sure.
For the very reason you say, that it was part of this very familiar recording.
Indeed.
As you point out in the book, Southbound, An Illustrated History of Southern Rock, Ronnie Van Zant, when they wrote this song, said, there, that's our Ramblin' Man.
Yeah.
He knew he had a hit on his hands.
Yeah.
We're talking about Lynyrd Skynyrd's iconic song, Freebird. Here's a little taste.
If I leave here tomorrow,
Skynyrd with the first single version of their song Freebird. And as Scott B. Bomar has told us, it was released as a single twice, first 40 years ago.
That's right, November 1974, it was released. The studio version was released as a single, went top 20 on the Billboard singles charts, and then they released it again in 1977 in a live version, and that was a top 40 single as well.
Since Freebird is 40 years a single and is still shouted out at concerts, random concerts across the country, we thought we'd take a look at the song, which turns out to have kind of a pivotal role to play in Lynyrd Skynyrd as a live band. You talk in the book about their first big tour opening for The Who.
Indeed, yeah. You know, one thing that people might not realize about Lynyrd Skynyrd is they were produced initially by Al Kooper. And Al Kooper is a guy who's been around the music business forever, most famously, probably best known for playing organ on Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, and actually plays organ on the studio version of Freebird. The first note you hear is the organ. That's Al Kooper.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed Al for the book, and he talked about, you know, standing on the side of the stage with the Who's manager, and, you know, Skynyrd went out there and just blew the crowd away, and nobody wanted to open for the Who back in those days. It was like, because obviously the Who is the Who. I mean, Skynyrd went out there on that tour and closed the show every night with Freebird, and the Who's manager looked at Al Kooper and said, you know, what is going on? And Al Kooper said, that's going to keep happening every night when they play this song, you know.
Because they were being asked for encores.
Yeah, which was unheard of.
Unheard of for an opening band.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Soundcheck listeners, you can listen on our website to our 2013 interview with a few of the longtime members of Lynyrd Skynyrd, in which they talk about this song, Free Bird. And as you might guess, they don't mind having audience members shout out that that song title during live shows. Lynyrd Skynyrd actually gets four chapters in your book.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, you know, in the Southern rock genre, the Allman Brothers Band and Lynyrd Skynyrd are the twin pillars mm-hmm. of the Southern rock world. And, you know, the way the book was put together was I highlight a lot of bands. There are a number of bands in here like Hydra and Grinder Switch that are not household names, but were certainly a big part of the Southern rock world. And, you know, I just thought, as influential and the heavy hitters that Skynyrd and the Allmans were, you know, it wouldn't be right to just sort of make every chapter kind of equal. So I did sections on the Allmans mm-hmm. and Skynyrd and talked about their different incarnations and different phases. Southern rock is just beset with tragedy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You have these pivotal, I mean, Ronnie Van Zant and Duane Allman are kind of these spiritual godfathers of Southern rock, and both die very young. And, you know, it's wild.
Well, now you alluded before to the stereotypes of Southern rock and the Southern rockers.
Yeah.
Duane Allman seems to be, I mean, is he a stereotypical Southern rocker, or was he... See, he always seemed to me to be like the doomed poet of the guitar,
right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
That somehow he was exempt from that, even though his behavior may have been exactly like everybody
right,
else's.
Right, right. Yeah, I think he transcended that in some ways, you know. Duane was no doubt the spiritual godfather of the Southern rock world. Duane was playing guitar down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, backing up all kinds of people, mm-hmm. backing up Aretha Franklin, backing up Wilson Pickett.
Wilson Pickett,
and,
yep.
You know, it was when Wilson Pickett recorded Hey Jude, it was Duane Allman who talked him into doing that song at all. And then at the end of the song, there's this vamp where Duane just kind of goes berserk on the guitar. And, you know, people point to that as sort of the birth of Southern rock. Southern rock world kind of grew up around Duane Allman and the Allman Brothers. And in some ways, the Allman Brothers have transcended that, but in a way that Lynyrd Skynyrd has not. I think that Lynyrd Skynyrd are sort of thought of in most people's minds who are just casual observers, that they sort of represent mm-hmm. Southern rock even more so than the Allmans.
Although, as we said, when Ronnie Van Zant of Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, when they finished Freebird, his thinking was, this is our Ramblin' Man, referencing the yeah. Allman Brothers Band.
Yeah, and Ronnie had, I mean, all the guys in Skynyrd, especially Ronnie, had huge respect for the Allman Brothers. And in fact, very frequently when they would play Freebird on stage, they would dedicate it to Duane Allman and also sometimes Barry Oakley, who was the bassist mm-hmm. in the Allmans, who passed away about a year after Duane. So they definitely had a lot of respect for the Allman Brothers and the road that they sort of laid out before them.
So we're talking about 40 years of Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird, their Ramblin' Man. Let's hear the original Allman Brothers song, Ramblin' Man.
Lord, I was born a Ramblin' Man.
Rogers with the song Ramblin' Man. Scott B. Bomar, the author of Southbound, an illustrated history of Southern rock, is with us here on Soundcheck. So, you know, that is one of the kind of Southern rock stereotypes. It's like three or four guitarists,
right,
you know, wailing
right.
away over right. a long stretch of time. But then, you know, especially with Lynyrd Skynyrd, there's the Confederate flag.
Right.
And you write in the book about how, you know, some of the members of the band identify as liberal. And,
right.
and to them, it had nothing to do with race. It had to do with rebel pride,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah.
So, and you also write about Rolling Stone doing, an article on Lynyrd Skynyrd or the Allman Brothers where they come across as just like, you know, drug-taking, redneck, yokels.
Yeah. The first piece that Rolling Stone ever did on the Allman Brothers was when Dwayne was still alive, and they sort of transliterated, for lack of a better word, their speech patterns and their accents and just this sort of, like, ridiculous, you know, stretching out all the vowel sounds and all that. And
so pretty becomes purdy.
And yeah, exactly. And you know, that burned the Allman Brothers on Rolling Stone for a while. It was a couple years before they were willing to do any Rolling Stone coverage again. But, yeah, you know, there was that sort of that image, and you bring up the rebel flag, which is a very contentious and painful symbol, you know, for
sure.
a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that in the context of that time, that you had something really interesting going on. People sometimes categorize Southern rock as quote-unquote redneck music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when these guys were in their garage bands as teenagers in high school and growing their hair long and sort of listening to hippie music, so to speak, they were certainly not rednecks. Back then, a redneck was a guy with a crew cut and, you know, was not interested in long-haired guys and rock and roll, you know. And so these guys were sort of outcasts. They were these freaky long-haired rock and rollers in the world of the South. And then what happened is, they became successful, and they go out into the larger world of rock and roll, and suddenly they kind of don't fit in there either because they drink sweet tea and they have accents, you know? And so in the larger world of rock and roll, people are like, hey, well, these guys are different. So they didn't quite fit in completely in the world of the South that they came from, and they didn't quite fit in the larger rock and roll world. And I think a lot of that rebel flag stuff was sort of a thumbing of the nose to those who kind of considered them less than or like they didn't fit in. It was a way of sort of saying, hey, we have regional pride.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously...
Well, and let's not forget the Allman Brothers Band, the original lineup, not an all-white lineup.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. So. The drummer, J-Mo, is still the drummer today, one of the two drummers, African-American. And all these guys cut their teeth on blues and R&B and black music. And, you know, not to say that there's no problems with it. I mean, obviously, the rebel flag was used in the civil rights movement as a way of you know, thumbing the nose at the federal government. And so, yeah, it's a difficult and awkward and a painful symbol. And so I just try to wrestle with that very directly in the book.
So is that why we're yelling Freebird and not Sweet Home Alabama? Because Freebird is just a song about a guy who wants to wander.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that yelling Freebird in a lot of ways is just a joke. And
right.
unfortunately, it's indicative of the fact that Lynyrd Skynyrd and Southern rock, in the eyes of a lot of people, has become a bit of a joke. And, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd was a great band, and unfortunately, I think some of that rebel flag stuff and some of the symbolism and some of the negative stereotypes that people have associated with them have kept critics from really recognizing what a great band they were.
Scott B. Bomar's book is Southbound, an illustrated history of Southern rock. Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird was released as a single 40 years ago, November, and still haunting concert venues around the country. Scott, thank you so much for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
Going and going and going. Freebird by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Okay, up next, I promise there will be no yelling of Freebird when virtuoso guitarist Blake Mills brings his band to the studio. Instead, you'll hear this rising star play a song from his new album, and if you're a fan already, he's going to play a couple of older songs, too. Blake Mills is next on Soundcheck.
I'm Al from Riverdale, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
Don't tell all our friends about me. Please, baby, don't tell our friends about me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Blake Mills has earned a reputation for being one of the best session guitarists out there. He's recorded with artists like Weezer, Danger Mouse, and Norah Jones. He's toured with Jenny Lewis, Julian Casablancas, and Fiona Apple. He's also a producer. But in 2010, he put out an album called Break Mirrors and soon found himself in the spotlight. Now, Blake Mills has released a second record. It's called Hi-Ho. And today he's brought his own band to the Soundcheck studio to play some of it for us. This first song is called Cry to Laugh. Here's Blake Mills live on Soundcheck.
On the hunt to feed all my little pains, broke a branch and scared away the game. Still tracking this big buck through the rain. I'll try, but I'll cry to laugh. Well, I can't tell when I'm being tricked. With pain, it looking like the odds of being fixed. Oh, to be the prime suspect in all of this, I'll try, but I'll cry to laugh. I tried believing that I could be a leading man. You just want to do as you always have done, but you can't. Did I ever really need your help? Or tell me something I already know about myself. Oh, was this a joke that only time tell? I'll cry whenever I try to laugh. I tried to leave.
That is Blake Mills live on Soundcheck. His song is called Cry to Laugh. You'll find it on the new album called Hi-Ho. Blake Mills singing and playing guitar with Tyler Chester at our piano, Sebastian Steinberg playing the bass, Stuart Johnson behind the drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Blake, to you and the guys, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's a good way to start because it had the kind of understated playing that seems to characterize. I mean, you've got a very gifted group of guys here who could probably play anything.
Truly.
And everybody is kind of, you get the sense that everyone's just kind of reining it in, you know, that
the gift is that they know what to play
and what not to play.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a session guy. You know, that's very often, you know, that's that kind of decision making, when to lay out, when to come in.
You know what's funny about being in sessions is that the stuff that you hold back tends to come out in between takes. When they're fixing something in the control right. room that's broken and the band starts playing some, you know, riff or something like that. And a lot of my favorite moments with most of the people in this band have been in between takes.
Yeah.
So that's the nature of what we do now on stage, is we play all the stuff that normally doesn't cut it for records.
So are you getting into jam band territory here? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're jamming. For to use a word I despise, absolutely. Yeah. We're jamming. We jamming.
Now, you have, as a guitarist, kind of evolved away from, you know, the usual trajectory for a guitarist. You learn your craft, you learn the chords, you learn some basic runs and fills, and then you get more and more and more, and you get faster and you get more virtuosic. You've gone kind of through all that and come out the other side, it seems. What was it that kind of, you know, what is your narrative as a guitarist? What were you going for?
I think now it's guided more by an attachment to music than the instrument itself. I think guitar maybe suffers from a little bit of associative ego. You know, it's a soloist's instrument. It's electrified. It's celebritized, if that's a word. I don't know. So there's a lot of like inertia pulling it maybe into the realm that you're talking about.
Right.
But as a music lover and somebody who spends more time listening than playing, I get a lot of joy out of finding musical things to do with it, or any other instrument for that matter, and maybe that has helped me stay away from some of the traps.
Right. So, I mean, right away on the album Hi Ho, there's the song If I'm Unworthy, uh-huh. which, you know, for the first couple of minutes, you're thinking, okay, here it is. This is kind of that kind of understated. And then this squall of guitar comes in. And it's not like a classic shredding guitar solo, mm-hmm. but it's definitely, you know, a kind of texture
yeah.
that is really surprising.
Well, it's certainly an instrument that lends itself to texture. I mean, there are people who've created entire personalities on the instrument based on texture,
right?
You know, and there's a lot of freedom to paint with interesting colors on the instrument. So yeah, why not?
Some of my favorite guitarists tend to be people like, you know, for example, David Torn.
Yeah.
Who, you know, you wouldn't know he's even playing a guitar.
Right.
What about for you? Who are the sort of the people who have that texture that you can immediately say, oh, I know who that is?
Well, there are too many to list to answer that question. But I really love the musicality in the playing of Anthony Wilson and Julian Lage are two players who are contemporary and I think are just absolutely killing it. I grew up listening to a lot of John Scofield and Derek Trucks and Ry Cooder, all people who again seem to coax more music mm-hmm. out of the instrument than is seemingly possible. But a lot of my favorite musicians are not guitar players. And I think that a lot of the people I just mentioned would maybe tell you the same. I mean, I know for sure some of them listen to a lot of other instruments to get inspiration for what to do on guitar, and again try to avoid some of the hang-ups that come with the instrument.
Well, you know, two of the people you mentioned, Derek Trucks, big fan of Indian and especially South Indian music,
yes.
the Carnatic classical music, and Ry Cooder, big fan of the music of West Africa and the Caribbean
yes.
and stuff. So, you know, there are people who are drawing from lots of other sounds, lots of other traditions.
Totally. Different dialects altogether. I've been a big music, world music fan since I was about 14 years old, and still searching for ways of trying to incorporate it into what I do and not to push it to the side as like some sort of
after hours
unique
thing.
Interest. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
The latest album's called Hi Ho. It is out now. Blake Mills is here with the band, so let's put them back to work.
Great. We're going to do another one for you guys that we have never played before, and it has not been played since the recording of the record, which was the first time it was ever played.
Okay.
So here is the
second time it was ever played.
Second time.
The radio debut is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Of
yeah.
Just Out of View from Blake Mills.
Last verse of that song somewhere. I'll have to go back to listen to the record.
That was a pretty convincing performance, though, for a first time out.
Yeah.
After having recorded the song, what? Must have been like a year ago.
Over that. We spent almost a year mixing the record. So, yeah, it's a deep cut.
Blake, this has been great having you guys here with us today.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
You have a song to play us out with?
Yeah. I've got a... I've got a song. I think I've got all the verses in mind.
So this is like golden oldie, right? This is from the first record.
Yeah, this is one that is really been a fun song to play for people and get a first impression, because there's some fun lines in there. This is called "It'll All Work Out." Wishing to raise my sister and me, and voted Nixon in the 70s. It would all work out. It'll all work out. My mother was the youngest child. No college education was never her style. She knew just how to make a quarterback smile. Stayed up at night trying to keep the checkbook tighter than a duck's ass going down a water slide. I know he tried. Became a victim of the mortgage spikes. Collections calling every night since 1999. In 10 more years, you think the interest rates decline. It'll all work out. College, get your knowledge straightened out. With an air of desperation in the way he sounded, like he'd bet on it, and now it seemed his odds were down. Thank you, Dad, I love you, I'll make you proud. I'm sorry if I never take a road you laid down, but out of town for quite a little while.
The stitches in your arm must have healed by now. That plumber in your heat is still out. Don't be scared, I know you can still throw down. And it'll all work out. It'll all work out. Nah, I don't feel a speck of hate. Really, no, I'm trying to get my story straight. When you called me from your car when you were on your way, with your friend from San Francisco that you told me was gay. Oh, I guess he was a closet straight. Boom, get it all out now. It'll all work out. It'll all work out. It'll all.
That's Blake Mills performing here in the Soundcheck studio in a song called It'll All Work Out. Well, we're out of time here, but you can find the podcast of this entire session on our website, soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll welcome the South African rapper Tumi to our studio. He'll be making his American debut, plus a conversation with the actress Lake Bell and more. See you back here then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.